This podcast of To The Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To The Point.
The dark side of pharmaceuticals. Do we need to take all these drugs? I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Today on the show, millions of Americans are using a rising number of prescription drugs for conditions ranging from teenage shyness to menopause. Do we need them? Are we in better health thanks to pharmaceutical advances? Or is the pharmaceutical industry selling sickness? On the eve of the new Medicare prescription drug plan, we'll ask, how did we become this pill-popping culture? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the electronic voting machine manufacturer Diebold once again swirls in controversy. First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To The Point from PRI. Our main topic today, pill popping in the USA. The average number of annual prescriptions per person in 1993 was 7. In 2004, it was 12, and growing. Millions of Americans are swallowing prescription drugs for a multitude of dysfunctions, and pharmaceutical companies are spending billions to persuade us to take them. We'll talk about the selling of sickness today on To The Point. On Reporters Notebook a bit later, Diebold, manufacturer of electronic voting machines, has a troubled history, and its troubles continue. Its chief executive has resigned, and it's been slapped with a class action lawsuit. Warren Olney digs into the Diebold story later in the show. First, this news. The saga of former energy giant Enron continues. One of the three former officers of the company, just scheduled to trial in a couple of weeks, struck a plea bargain with prosecutors yesterday afternoon in Houston. Former Chief Accounting Officer Richard Causey will give up information to strengthen the case against his former colleagues, Kenneth Lay and Jeffrey Skilling. Here to go over the results yesterday, the news, is John Emschweiler, who's a senior writer for the Wall Street Journal and author of the recent book on the Enron scandal. The title, 24 Days, How Two Wall Street Journal Reporters Uncovered the Lies That Destroyed Faith in Corporate America. Mr. Emschweiler, thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure.
Let's talk about what went down yesterday. I understand that Mr. Causey is probably going to be facing 5 to 7 years. You're an insider. What happened a year ago when he was offered what was called an extremely lenient plea agreement? Would that have been even less?
Well, it's not clear exactly what he got offered a year ago. We heard different and conflicting stories about that. And there's been talks off and on for probably more than that with Mr. Causey. But generally, if you do it earlier, you can maybe get a somewhat better deal than if you do it later. He's still getting a better offer than they gave to Andy Fastow, the former chief financial officer, who had up to now been sort of their star catch in the ongoing investigation of Enron. So all things considered, I mean, he faces a significant amount of time in jail, but not nearly as long as he could have gotten if he would have been convicted on all counts.
Now, you mentioned Andrew Fastow. The way I read it is that Mr. Causey's potential information could be more damaging to Lay and Skilling than Fastow's could. Do you agree with that? Do we know anything about that?
Well, it could be. Certainly, Rick Causey was there as their chief accountant, was intimately involved in a lot of the accounting and decisions that are at the heart of the case against Mr. Lay and Mr. Skilling. So in that sense, he could be very valuable. And he's also, by most accounts, you know, a very likable guy who might come off very well to a jury, whereas Mr. Fastow was not nearly as well liked at Enron, and many people think would have a harder time being a sympathetic figure to jurors. So in that sense, they might get a double win by having Causey to supplement or even, you know, supplant Fastow for some of the testimony.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I'm just picturing the defense lawyer team right now. I guess they have the trial's been pushed back by a couple of weeks, but, you know, now they're going to have to cross-examine a man who has been strategizing with the defense team for years, maintaining his innocence. How does this change their case?
Well, it's going to be a challenge, to say the least. They're still putting on, you know, the same basically brave front that they've been putting on, which is and they may well believe it, that they, you know, that they're saying our clients are innocent and they did nothing wrong, and we don't think Mr. Causey will hurt us because he's proclaimed to us repeatedly over the last year that he's an innocent man and that he knows of nothing that either Jeff Skilling or Ken Lay did that was illegal. So if Mr. Causey takes the stand, presumably they will try to replay those kind of statements of innocence to Mr. Causey as a way to continue to bolster their argument that their clients are guilty of nothing.
You know, you're the expert, really, on this case. You've spent a good part of your career on it. How long has literally the case been going on at this point, and what do you think the trial will take?
Well, Enron collapsed into bankruptcy on December 2nd, 2001, after a very brief but tumultuous couple of months. And there's been an investigation going on at a federal level almost since then. So we're talking 4 years now. The trial's going to start at the end of next month now, and that's probably going to last 3 or 4 months. So by, you know, June of this next year, we may have a certain closure on Enron, at least from the point of view of the major figures having gone through their criminal trials.
And it's such a long time coming, isn't it? It feels like the crisis was a long time ago.
It is, by, you know, in news terms, it is eons ago.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so it's been a long investigation, a complicated one. It's probably been the biggest corporate crime investigation in the history of the U.S. government. And while they've gotten a number of people to plead guilty, this is the 16th person, Mr. Causey, the two biggest targets remain out there.
Yeah, one more question, if I could, Mr. Imschwell, and that is the jury. Is it true? I understand that in the Houston area, not just a few, but hundreds of residents have been notified that they're in the pool of potential jurors, and none of them have been admonished to stay away from the press on their media reports about the case. But now, boy, it's swelled up huge as of yesterday.
Right. Now, that's going to be another issue that the judge is going to have to deal with, and I guess they always have to deal with in high-profile, highly publicized cases, is how tainted is the jury pool. The defense attorneys have been arguing that, you know, it's terribly tainted, and therefore we need to move the trial to another city.
But John Imschweller, I'm sorry, out of time at the moment, but we sure do appreciate all your insight.
Anytime.
A subject you know well. John
Imschweller.
We'll be back in just a moment with more of To the Point from PRI.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
I'm Diana Nyad, back with To the Point. Warren Olney's on vacation this week. We used to be grateful for a prescription for a pill to help us with a migraine headache or an extreme stomach flu, but now our medicine cabinets are bulging with pills for erectile dysfunction, insomnia, indigestion, high cholesterol, anxiety, restless leg syndrome. Some critics argue that the pharmaceutical industry has created a culture of desire for drugs we don't need. Well, Alan Castles is co-author of Selling Sickness, How the World's Biggest Pharmaceutical Companies Are Turning Us All Into Patients. And he joins us now from Victoria, Canada. Alan Castles, welcome to the program.
Good day.
Listen, I wonder if we could start with a bit of a timeline, kind of a macro view of this. I read sort of the eye-popping story in your book of the head of Merck of pharmaceuticals some 30 years ago having this vision of selling drugs almost like chewing gum. He just wanted, literally he said, I want to make drugs for healthy people. So give us an idea in those 30 years how the pill-popping has escalated in our culture.
For sure. I mean, Henry Gadsden, who's head of Merck, made an astounding frank admission to Fortune magazine in 1976 that he wanted Merck to be like, the chewing gum maker Wrigley's, because he wanted to sell to everyone, not contented with just making drugs for sick people. He wanted to create what he called healthy people drugs. And I think in the last 30 years, we've essentially seen that happen to a massive degree, where the pharmaceutical industry now is not just creating the very and sometimes very important chemicals to treat many of our ailments, but at the same time are shaping and manipulating the diseases and our perception of those diseases that those drugs are to treat. And you know, I think in the last 30 years, yes, the sheer volume of drugs that we as a society are consuming, the amount of our basically our national resources and our wealth that's going towards pharmaceutical treatments is, I think, very much out of proportion to the benefits that we get as humankind.
Now, you went back to 1976 with the Merck story, but, you know, the direct-to-consumer advertising, you know, has certainly been more of a phenomenon of, let's say, the last decade. So has there been a direct correlation there with more prescriptions even?
Well, I think so. You know, in the United States in 1996, we're almost 10 years ago when there was a slight change to the law. The U.S. FDA started allowing direct-to-consumer advertising of pharmaceuticals. That really put the whole marketing of drugs directly to consumers, that really put it in a sort of in-your-face context. You know, drugs are not like computers or cars. You can't go and buy them off the shelf. There's a reason why we require a learned intermediary like a doctor to prescribe them. Though this idea that you would advertise something directly to the buyers means that you're essentially bypassing the doctor. And that is proven for some drugs to be a massively successful way of getting rapid uptake of your drug.
Mm-hmm. Well, just go to the title of your book, at least the big title is Selling Sickness, which I guess reverts back even to, again, this Henry Gadsden quote of saying he wants to sell drugs to healthy people. So is your argument, your thesis, that there are now drugs for sheer non-illnesses?
I wouldn't say that they're non-illnesses. I would say that they're, I mean, every drug has its place. Even things like, social anxiety disorder or, we'll say, attention deficit disorder in children. People at the extreme end of the spectrum, some people do benefit from taking pharmaceuticals, and those drugs are there to help them, and it's good that we have them. Though, when you start saying that every kid who's hyperactive overactive in school needs to be given a stimulant to settle them down, that's a completely different story. You're now taking what might be a social problem and creating a medical condition around that so that you can sell more and more drugs, and they've been simply very successful at doing that.
But just to play devil's advocate a bit here, Mr. Castles, I'm just wondering, though, if, you know, one view, and certainly your book takes this view, is that the pharmaceutical companies almost alone have expanded the definition, the boundaries of what is illness, all right? But couldn't it just be that we are medically more and more sophisticated day by day, and now we have a much more subtle view of an understanding of all the different problems that go on in the body, and we should be lucky that there are drugs that can help all these different problems?
You know, at one level, you're right, but at the other level, there's a massive amount of deception happening. Let's take something like high cholesterol, which, 15 years ago was not considered an illness. Now, people are regularly reminded that they need to get out there and get their numbers tested to see whether they should be taking cholesterol-lowering drugs. The benefits of those drugs for people who haven't had heart disease or haven't had a heart attack are marginal to non-existent. The massive amounts of marketing that go behind scaring people into getting their cholesterol tested, you know, I don't think at one level we are a more sophisticated buying public. I think we're very easily manipulated, and I think that health professionals, physicians, and specialists largely who are in the employ of the pharmaceutical companies have really aided and abetted that happening.
Yeah, let's take another example, that might counterpoint that, and that is that, you know, it was kind of the ma and pa phrase. For decades and decades, we would say to a kid, oh, he's just got a little runny nose. Well, now that we know more, and allergies and asthma, you know, are such a big part of youth illness in this country, and of course, with the foul air and processed foods we have, we know that a lot of kids don't just have a runny nose. It's not just a simple little catchphrase. They have something called nasal rhinitis, and there are medicines that help these kids tremendously.
Right. And, you know, at one level, it's great that we've got medicines that help some people tremendously. At the same point, you know, because there is so much dominance of the pharmaceutical industry in directing really where the research money goes, how much of that research around, say, environmental causes of asthma or allergies and so on is really happening? And I would argue that very little is. If you can't patent cleaning up the air, you're simply not going to be you're not going to be directing research money towards that. So really, in the dominance of the patent pharmaceutical industry, these other ways that we could be researching and looking for solutions and even preventative causes for a lot of these conditions simply don't happen.
So you're really making the case that, you know, yes, as we've said before, the thesis of your book is the pharmaceutical companies turning us all into patients. But on the other hand, you're saying if we just would look into the mental aspects, the environmental aspects, you know, really dig into why we're experiencing a number of valid symptoms, menopause, for instance, that we wouldn't have to turn to pills all the time in such huge numbers.
Exactly. You know, we call the book Selling Sickness, but you might say at one level, if they're selling sickness, well, who's buying it? And at one level, we would say that the pharmaceutical industry has been very successful at convincing physicians that any problem can be described as a medical problem, whether it's activity of kids in schools, whether it's the level of someone's cholesterol, whether it's a woman going through a natural process of aging and going through menopause. If that can be reconfigured as an estrogen deficiency, and you can convince physicians that that's proper medicine to be treating that with drugs all the time, you can create a very successful business out of doing that.
Let's get a response from what you're putting out there from Robert Goldberg, who's the director of the Center for Medical Progress at the Manhattan Institute. That's a conservative think tank in New York City, and we should mention that that center does receive some funding from pharmaceutical companies. Mr. Goldberg, thank you for being with us.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I was too busy taking all the Viagra that was being advertised on TV.
And how are you feeling?
Oh, I am ready to go, Diana. Alan is a... I've read his book. It's a very silly book. As Mark Twain said, beware of health books. You may die of a misprint.
So why do you call this book silly?
Well, because, it is outdated, as is much of the debate and discussion that we're having here today. We are entering an era of personalized medicine. Each human, each one of us, differs by less than 1% of their genetic makeup. And these genetic differences, give rise to physical differences, including potential real, not made up, not marketed predisposition to various diseases. So, for example, Alan said something about cholesterol being a made-up disease. In fact, we now have, within the next 2 to 3 years, there will be on the market genetic tests that will show you to what extent you are at risk of a heart disease as a result, and to what extent changes in your cholesterol will reduce that risk, and also the correlation between reducing cholesterol and heart inflammation, which is very, very important. So our increasing ability to examine our individual genetic makeup will allow us to customize medical treatment. We'll be designing drugs around people, not people around drugs, and not drugs around people. What else is going to happen? I'm sure it'll make Alan and your other guests very happy. Is this, this era of pushing one size fits all medicine to a mass population is over. It's dead. It's done. We're going to have an era, we're already entering an era of predictive, preventive, and personalized medicine. And let me give you one example,
okay,
which is very personal and dear to my heart. There is something which 20 years ago you never heard of. It's called female athlete triad. It's a combination of eating disorder, bulimia or anorexia, interrupted menstrual cycle, and osteoporosis. My daughter suffers from that. For years and years and years, she went to pediatricians who told me and my wife that it was in their mind, or they were just being overly sensitive, that it was being pushed by the drug companies, and so on and so forth. And finally, she had to get into a, unfortunately, had to be in a eating disorder clinic. There was a drug that was used. And there's a group out there called Public Citizen who does nothing but tell people how dangerous all drugs are. There's a drug on the market called Abilify, which, according to Public Citizen, is a dangerous drug and shouldn't be on the market because of something or other. It was the only drug that doesn't induce weight gain, which, of course, with bulimic is a very, very, is a very, very important thing. And it was as a result of taking that drug that her mental condition was stable enough for her to be able to eat and stabilize her heart and other bodily functions. I am now working with the eating disorder clinic with grant money to develop algorithms that will personalize eating disorder treatment, so we actually have not only individualized outcomes, but try to see if there are genetic variations that will allow customized treatments. So to suggest that somehow, like you pointed out, Diana, that we're getting increasingly sophisticated in our ability to treat medicines. Now, it's going to change the way that drug companies do business, the way they market companies. Anyone who's going to try to shove drugs down people's throats like chewing gum are going to be on the sidelines. But to individualize our ability to treat young women like my daughter, they're going to be the winners. And the fearmongers or the peddlers are going to lose out. So that both Public Citizen and a drug company like Merck that wants to market a one-size-fits-all drug, they're both going to be the losers. But patients are going to be the winners in this new era of personalized medicine.
Well, let me let Alan Castles come back in, first of all, to respond to your comment about his book being silly, but also to ask you, Mr. Castles, I mean, it sounds a lot of what Robert Goldberg is talking about is certainly the wave of the future, literal DNA testing, perhaps even before one is born to know what syndromes one's coming into, and the one-size-fit-all drug won't work. But do you agree, of course, not in the silly part of characterization of your book, do you agree anything of what he's saying, that the pharmaceutical, you know, push is over?
I'd like to know more about why the book is silly, but in terms of saying that the future of medicine is around genetic tests, and sort of customized medicine, the only question I would have is, who is going to pay for that? I mean, currently we do have very effective medicines that treat, you know, a wide spectrum of the population, and those medicines, because they're priced out of reach of a lot of consumers, are simply being not used to the degree they should be. The pharmaceutical industry is not really that interested, I think, in creating customized medicine, because there's not going to be a sufficient profit in doing so. They want to create, say, the next Celebrex or the next Vioxx that gets used by every single person who think they might have arthritis. That's where the market is. To think that the future of the pharmaceutical industry research depends on sort of niche medicine, you know, I simply say yes, maybe for some rich people who might be able to pay for it, but that's really not the market. That's not where the market is.
It seems to me that it makes a lot of sense, actually, but we're not there yet.
Yeah, and it would be great if we could have good drugs that could target people with bulimia, for example. You know, I think that there's a lot of other kinds of research that needs to happen around, you know, body image and things like that for young women, and I think that kind of stuff is going to probably lead to better solutions than trying to find, you know, what might be the specific little bit of your DNA makeup that might predispose you towards the condition.
Okay, hang on. Alan Castles, Robert Goldberg, we'll be right back, and we have a couple other good guests, too, in just a minute. More To the Point.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney today on To the Point. We're discussing our dependence on pills these days, and the drug industry markets to us so heavily these days, especially on television. And I want to go back to Robert Goldberg, who's the director of the Center for Medical Progress at the Manhattan Institute in New York City. Mr. Goldberg, first of all, if you feel that the whole era really is passé, that the pharmaceutical companies are not involved anymore, really in the mass marketing and they don't want that next Vioxx, as Alan Castles claims, then why do we still see so many commercials? I mean, for mass market drugs on television, I feel that if I sat there, you know, during a football game or something, I could count them by the dozens.
Well, look, you know, we are at a turning point. They're still there, obviously, but the science is moving in this direction. We now have several genetic tests that will allow you to figure out which drug is appropriate regarding specific to your metabolism. Many of all the new cancer drugs are specific to the kinds of the way your gene expresses your particular protein. Maybe they don't make them available in Canada because they like to ration medicines there. But here in the United States, within the next 5 years, we'll probably effectively cure many forms of breast cancer and probably kidney cancer because of those targeted types of medicines. We will have a gene test for how to tailor treatments for using not only existing drugs on the market for blood thinning and hypertension, but new drugs on the market. Many of those drugs, because they have already screened out those people for whom they don't work, will move for the market and drug development faster, and they'll be much more cost-effective. Let me give you another example. We just saw an article in the papers over the weekend. There are 56,000 liver problems associated with taking Tylenol. That costs people hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Those kinds of things will be a thing of the past, probably within 5 years, because of a simple genetic test that people will be able to take in their doctor's office. Many, many problems associated with adverse drug events, which cost the system billions of dollars, will evaporate within 5 years. This is not science fiction, Diana. This is real. And to the extent that people see benefits, unlike a socialist system like Canada, the market will change, and healthcare systems in the United States, managed care plans, Medicare, and so on, are paying for these genetic tests because they know that if you do it right the first time, it saves a tremendous amount of money, and we do care about quality of life as well as the cost.
No, listen, what you're describing, genetic testing and getting to the specificity of need of a drug, which then, of course, as you describe it, you know, avoids already the poor reaction to a drug one doesn't need in one system. It all sounds like nirvana. It sounds wonderful.
Well, I just had my daughter.
Are we really there? I mean, you think of the millions and millions of people in this country who possibly don't even have enough money to go to a doctor during the year, so they see an ad on television for insomnia. That's their problem. They go and, you know, quickly get it as they can, even on the internet.
Well, first of all, you know, there's a lot of undertreatment of diseases, and even people that have drug coverage, 50% of people with hypertension with drug coverage don't even get the drug. So there's a lot of undertreatment, there's overtreatment, there's mistreatment. You have to disaggregate. What I'm speaking about is a system where within the framework of, you know, healthcare coverage, you're providing the right drug to the right person at the right time using better tools and more sophistication. You spoke about asthma. You know, we've identified 10 different pathways for asthma triggers. Companies are already working on those kinds of things. Why? Because the market as it exists and these drugs don't work, and you know, like in a market system, people, you know, make money by finding better, more effective products. You know, it's just like when you set the record for swimming across the channel, there was someone else out there trying to beat you, right?
I mean, you're right on my heels.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what competition is all about. Whereas in Europe or in Canada, you know, where the government sets the price and they restrict access just on the price alone, there are still women in Canada and in Europe dying of breast cancer because they don't have access to those targeted tests and targeted treatments.
Okay, hold on. I want to hear from Dr. Robert Goodman now. He's the Assistant Professor of Clinical Medicine at the Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, also the founder of a project called No Free Lunch, and he'll tell us about that in a moment. Dr. Goodman, thank you for your time.
Sure, thank you.
Let's first of all talk about this issue that Mr. Goldberg is bringing up about, as a clinician, do you see medicine going in this very individualized, almost genetic testing route? I mean, is it available to us really now?
Well, so obviously the answer to that is no, and I am a practicing physician and was practicing up until about 2 a.m. last night, so I'm sorry for being a little bit tired right now.
Okay, thanks for being with us.
If Mr. Goldberg accuses Allen of being a little outdated, the obvious retort to that is he is living in the future a little bit, and maybe I won't call it science fiction, but it's certainly not what's happening now, and the marketing and what's going on with industry and the doctors has nothing to do with genetics. It has nothing to do with individualized medicine, like he points out. I mean, the social anxiety disorder, the gastroesophageal reflux disease, irritable bowel syndrome, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, none of this have the slightest thing, and Mr. Goldberg is well aware of this, of individualized, personalized medicine. But and that's what's going on right now, and these are the things that Allen talks about in his book. And it certainly, as someone who's practicing today, is not at all out of date.
Well, we talked about, you bring up finally the doctors, and being that you're one, let's talk about the hard sell that the pharmaceutical industry does on you guys.
Well, I think this is something that anybody who's been a patient, I think that's probably most of your listening audience, is aware of. They've been to a doctor's office, and they see the branded clocks, and the doctors writing with the branded pens and drinking from the branded coffee mugs, is aware of the billions of dollars industry spends promoting their products to doctors. And my organization actually isn't telling industry that they can't do this, right? We support the free market system. But what we are doing is telling doctors as well as medical students that they should get their information from non-promotional sources, which is very easy to do now in the 21st century, and should not accept, most importantly, should not accept gifts from industry, because, of course, these can lead to conflicts of interest and can influence doctors, and there's lots of evidence showing this to be the case, influence doctors in prescribing oftentimes inappropriate medication, more expensive, newer medication than they'd actually otherwise prescribe.
So is that actually what no free lunch is?
That's exactly right. And that, you know, it refers to the free lunches as well as free dinners that are ubiquitous in doctors' offices. As many patients will tell me, as reps have rolled in the lunches and the carts into their doctor's office while they were waiting to see their doctor.
You know, maybe you could give us an idea of a typical medical professional conference and what sorts of, you know, goodies. It's like when you go to a sports expo.
Well,
you go from booth to booth to booth for 2 days and go home with a beautiful bag of goodies. Is that what's happening with doctors as well?
It certainly is. If anyone's been to a professional society meeting, it certainly is like a trade show. You know, if you think about it, the professional societies are really supposed to be setting the standards for individual doctors on how they should behave. And many of these, most interestingly and ironically, many of these professional societies have rather nice, stringent guidelines about accepting gifts. And, in fact, one, for example, the American College of Physicians actually tells doctors that they ideally shouldn't accept any gifts. Yet their yearly annual scientific meeting has an exhibit hall, which is literally like a circus, with doctors given handed shopping bags. They walk through the hall and they collect gifts as they wander throughout the exhibit hall. So, well, individual doctors may just be human and fail once in a while. The professional society should be doing a little better job, and they're clearly failing the profession, and by doing so are failing patients.
I want to come back to you, and before I go to Dr. Larry Fields, can I ask you if you write as fast as you talk, Dr. Goodman?
I'm from New York City.
I understand. Dr. Larry Fields is with us today, too, a family physician based in Ashland, Kentucky. He's president of the American Academy of Family Physicians, which is a professional organization representing some 94,000 doctors. Dr. Fields, thank you for joining the conversation.
Thank you, Diane. It's nice to be with you. Right, and well, I don't talk as fast.
No, you're from Kentucky, and so we're really going to be able to understand you. Dr. Goodman just describes this, you know, kind of looks like a big party at these conferences, and there is some seduction going on of a doctor leaving with wonderful coffee mugs and, you know, whatnot, and maybe it influences him or her to order that particular drug from that company when they get home. Does that happen at these conventions? You actually run these conventions, some of them.
Yes, we do. Actually, we have a large meeting once a year in the late summer or early fall, our annual meeting, which does have a big exhibit hall. I actually was chair of that meeting in 2000 in Dallas. We really, as an academy, our staff actually runs the exhibit hall, but we do have hundreds of exhibitors. However, I think the characterization of doctors walking through these booths and collecting gifts is a little bit of hyperbole. I'm not sure that how many coffee mugs you can take home on an airplane,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not sure that a coffee mug would actually make you prescribe a drug that you wouldn't ordinarily prescribe or a pen that's, you know, worth about 5 cents, or a post-it note.
No, but I guess the point is, just as we consumers who are, you know, and these are fear-based ads, you know, you see an ad that has even relates to a slight symptom that you might have, and all of a sudden you expand that in your mind, you say, that's it, that's what I've got. I need that drug immediately. So for the doctors, you know, I know any of us who goes into a doctor's office while you're sitting there in the waiting room, you see, you know, several sellers coming in with their little roll tote bags behind them. So you doctors must be inundated with salespeople, and it must be sometimes difficult to discern what is the right drug or what has been the good sell.
Well, it's not difficult because you have all kinds of information available, as has been alluded to already, that is not provided by the pharmaceutical companies. You have online information. You have information on your PDA. Frequently, patients will mention certain drugs, and that opens up an opportunity for a family physician to have a dialogue with a patient about, well, exactly why do you think, you know, you have this particular problem or need this drug, or this drug is not, in your case, the best for you, and this is why. So it actually does sometimes provide opportunities to actually get to the real reason the patient is in the office for a visit anyway, because it's not always the apparent high blood pressure. There may be something else going on, particularly if it's related to sleep disturbance or anxiety, which they may be reluctant to mention. So if they bring it up in that way, the family physician can use that opportunity to discuss the underlying problem and get to the root of the reason the patient's there.
Would, as a family physician, do you see any reality to what Robert Goldberg described before as the upcoming, you know, analysis, very, very specific and almost genetic analysis of every single patient? Where you are in Ashland, Kentucky, is that what's happening in doctors' offices?
No, I'm still waiting for the tricorder from Star Trek to become available. Until then, I'm
you do have Coca-Cola down there, though, don't you?
Yes, we do, actually. He is right in that we are going in that direction. The Human Genome Project has been a fantastic scientific achievement,
mm-hmm.
and we will certainly all benefit from that in the future. We do have some drugs that are targeted. There's just been a new antihypertensive medicine marketed that is specifically for African American. It's not, you know, as specific as we're talking about an individual. But we are moving in that direction. I have no doubt that at some point in the future that it will get here. But I don't think it will be 5 years, but it will come.
Well, that's a good thing. But on the whole, your big picture statement, you know, is there a problem in terms of pharmaceuticals almost creating more need for drugs than there is?
Well, I don't think so. And let me explain that answer a little bit. I mean, part of the premise in the book that we've been discussing is that pharmaceutical companies promote drugs to treat people who aren't sick yet. And you have to say, that's not a bad idea. I mean, we prescribe all kinds of medications to control blood sugars, blood pressure, high cholesterol levels. There are many drugs in each category, and we do tailor those to individuals as much as possible based on symptoms and other drugs. But my point is that what we're trying to do is we're trying to treat people before they have their heart attack, go blind, have their kidneys fail, or have a stroke. If we're suggesting that we wait until somebody suffers a catastrophic medical event before we treat them with drugs, I'm not sure that the public or the medical profession would actually be buying into that.
And that's preventative. Let's bring Dr. Goodman back in, Dr. Robert Goodman, who's at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. Dr. Goodman, one area before we run out of time today we haven't touched on at all is the drug companies being behind so much of medical research. Isn't there a compromise of interest and ethics there?
Well, that's a complicated area, and not so black and white as the issue of individual clinicians accepting gifts and enticements from industry, which is one of the reasons why I focus on the clinicians and the professional societies. There's definitely problems associated with the close, intimate relationship, and lots of books have been written about this recently, between academia and industry. Arguments definitely can be made for this arrangement, and I think certainly good things have come from it, but there is a concern, for one thing, that the research agenda will be greatly distorted, research being done on things that are profitable rather than things that are necessary for the public's health. So there are definitely problems and conflicts.
Okay. Thank you for that. I want to finish up today, go full circle, and come back to Alan Castles, who's written a book called Selling Sickness, How the World's Biggest Pharmaceutical Companies Are Turning Us All Into Patients. Now, Mr. Castles, for the last 20 or so minutes, you've heard a lot of different theories running around, and I want you to have the last word. To wrap up, where do we really stand, in your view, with pharmaceutical companies and syndromes that perhaps we do or don't need drugs for today?
Yeah. You know, I think at the end of the day, when a person goes to their doctor, they want to be confident that the doctor is making the best decision for them based on the evidence and based on good quality science, not based on, you know, who is the one that dropped off the nicest coffee mugs or who attended which briefings financed by the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, it's not just the level at the prescribing, but in terms of who is directing and who do physicians themselves turn to. We've got organizations such as the National Cholesterol Education Program that directs physicians how they should be treating cholesterol. And when those organizations are underwritten by the very pharmaceutical companies that have a opportunity to make a lot of money, I think what happens is that it's undermining the average person's confidence in the system.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on the subject for today, Mr. Castles, but we thank you for being here and congratulations on your book, Selling Sickness. To Robert Goldberg, Dr. Robert Goodman, and Dr. Larry Fields also, thanks very much for being here. On Reporter's Notebook in just a minute, Diebold is an Ohio company that makes electronic voting machines used all over the country. Well, a series of incidents has cast doubt on Diebold's claims of integrity. Did unreliable technology play a role in last year's close election victory for President Bush? In a moment, Warren Olney finds out more about Diebold on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
I'm Warren Olney with Reporter's Notebook. Diebold first made national headlines when CEO Walden Odell wrote a fundraising letter promising to deliver the votes of Ohio to President Bush in last year's presidential election. That raised eyebrows sky high because Ohio uses Diebold machines. Earlier this month, Odell resigned after two class action suits, charges of insider trading, and discovery by a Florida county that Diebold's machines can be hacked to change votes. Julie Carr Smythe covers politics for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Julie, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
You shook up the political world in Ohio yourself earlier this month with reports about Diebold executives contributing to Republican politicians. What'd you find out?
Well, what we found out was that after the company had banned giving by a series of the very highest executives, that some others were giving, and it wasn't so much that they had broken the ban or violated the company policy, but I think it continued to raise eyebrows about this company and its political involvement and the fact that it had really never, brought itself into the reality that it was in the voting machine business now and it needed to conduct itself differently.
So after Mr. Odell's statement then, high executives at Diebold were banned from making contributions, but others were not, and that's what you found.
Correct. And what we found was that actually there had been three, one in a far-flung New York subsidiary and then a couple local folks in the Canton, Ohio area who had given small amounts. So it wasn't so much the giving itself as much as it was just the fact that most of the public, I think, perceived that Diebold was going to stop doing this. And even though the policy only set out the CEO and the CFO and a couple others, I think that most people thought that they weren't giving. And when they started seeing them giving again, it raised some red flags.
Did it raise red flags with Democrats about President Bush's victory in Ohio last year?
Indeed. it has been a major sort of undertow of all the political conversation is the security of the machines, the political leanings of Walden Hotel, and basically the safety and security of electronic voting in general.
There were concerns about Ohio. It was the key state in the presidential election. And, of course, the Secretary of State there, Ken Blackwell, is a Republican. What has he had to say about all this?
Well, he conducted some very intensive security reviews prior to certifying the machines in Ohio, and he has continued to assert that everything is has been thoroughly checked, examined, and that our system here in Ohio is safe and sound, and that it cannot be hacked.
Well, now, though, we have this incident in Leon County, Florida. Tell us about that.
Well, I think that what is interesting about it is that sort of all the conspiracy theories that have been floating around since the 2004 election have been verified in a sense, in that a Board of Elections official, I believe, had had someone come in and try to hack the machines, and they succeeded. I'm not intimately involved with the story, but I think that that's what I have heard from the Florida front.
Well, that's right indeed. It was Ion Sancho, who is the supervisor of elections in Leon County. He's actually been on our program a number of times. In that case, there were optical machines that scan paper ballots. They were not the same kind of electronic machines, I believe, that work in Ohio. But in some ways, I suppose, that's even worse, because a paper trail is supposed to be what will save the computers from all this skepticism.
Right. And in our case, we had made into law last year in Ohio that we would have a paper trail, but it was proceeding to take full effect in this coming year. And it was called, you know, a system called Voter Verified Paper Audit Trail, or VPAT, and it has been difficult to make it come to pass because of the fact that the technology had never been invented. And so then you added a new wrinkle into this, that basically you are trying to add security layers, but what you're doing is adding yet another piece of technology that has not been up and running in an election.
How many states other than Ohio and Florida are you aware of where there are Diebold voting machines?
California has had some major headlines about their use of Diebold in some of their counties. Georgia, I believe, picked Diebold statewide, as did, I think, Maryland. You know, in other words, they are across the nation. They are definitely used quite widely.
Now, in addition to all the things we've talked about, a couple of class action lawsuits and charges of insider trading, how have they hurt Diebold, and how's it doing, headquartered as it is there in Ohio?
Well, I suspect that the class action lawsuits are a major worry to the stockholders, and may have, in fact, had a lot more to do with Walden O'Dell's resignation than anything to do with a small amount of giving on the part of several, you know, far-flung executives. I think that they have had some trouble financially with their ATM division, as well as with their voting machine division. Overall, they're a pretty strong company. It's just that every time an election rolls around, they face this continued criticism about the voting machine aspect and the politics.
Again, we're talking with Julie Carr Smythe with the Cleveland Plain Dealer. What about Walden O'Dell? This would be old news in Ohio, but how did he explain it after he had said in a fundraising letter he was going to do everything he could to make sure that President Bush won in Ohio? How did he explain the fact that somehow that didn't apply to the fact that his company had voting machines in Ohio?
It was twofold. One was he initially said he didn't write the letter, and that was standard language that would come out of the Ohio Republican Party on any fundraiser, was, you know, sort of excitement over delivering the votes for the presidential candidate of that party. Secondly, he did eventually come out and just publicly apologize for being so active. I mean, he was down at the ranch in Crawford, Texas, shortly before that fundraiser, getting his marching orders as a pioneer or ranger in terms of how much money he should earn, and he had to come out and say, listen, I just made a mistake. I have been in a business that was not connected with voting machines because this was an ATM maker. And once we bought this division, I realized I need to change the way I do things.
Once again, of course, Diebold has voting machines in a lot of different states. That's led the New York Times to say this in an editorial. The counting of votes is a public trust. Diebold, whose machines count many votes, has never acted as if it understood this. Does it appear, even with these most recent revelations of yours about contributions, that Diebold is going to change its ways as far as politics are concerned?
Well, I really think that they just hope that if Walden O'Dell is out of the headlines, that the successors down the line will not have that name recognition and will not be able to generate the kind of news that he has. But I think that that's a very good point, that they sort of seem to be going around with business as usual, as if they weren't a company that was in a very specialized business of voting machines. And eventually states might have to start talking about restricting these things in statute in terms of, you know, just in the same way we other companies are not allowed to give when they're doing business with the state.
All right. Well, thank you so much for helping us out.
Not a problem.
That was Warren Olney talking to Julie Carr Smythe from the Cleveland Plain Dealer about the Diebold Company's controversies. Today's program was produced by Francis Anderton with Jonah King, Karen Radziner, and Katie Cooper. The technical director is J.P. Costello. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Diana Nyad. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW, Santa Monica, and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.